sort of had a slow motion breakdown, really. It may be anxiety, it may be low energy, low mood. It may be the sense that something isn't quite flowing in the way that it might.
When will enough be enough? When will we be content?
More is the cry of a mistaken soul. Freedom is over time become a very different person. Notice it and to take it seriously. Not just try and build in more and more distractions to kind of anaesthetize the dawning sense of dread.
If you've reached that kind of that breaking point, where do I go next?
Mark, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me on. I'm intrigued as to where our conversation might go.
So am I. I'm excited to pick your brains. So we start off the same way. I'm going to hit you with a big open question. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
So professionally, I guess, my life is a mixture of working as a psychotherapist and writing. So I write books, but also journalism and then other things to do with writing, non-fiction, but that might be contributing, thought and opinion online, on the radio, as well as in articles for newspapers and so on. And I think the problem that both those elements revolve around is the place of inner life in the modern world. How do we take what's going on inside, not just our individual psyche, you might say, but the collective psyche? How do we take that seriously in a world that's very, very driven by results, behavior, metrics, the abstract? How can things like the imagination, how can matters of spirit and soul, how can feelings become, modes of insight, not just things that either help you or hinder you in life? So yeah, inner life in the modern world perhaps is the problem.
Nice. Okay, so if I found myself, say I was a client of yours and I found myself working with you, what kind of symptoms do you think I might be facing in my day-to-day life for you to help me?
It might be the kinds of things that do get talked about and spoken about quite a lot now. It may be anxiety, it may be low energy, low mood. It may be the sense that something isn't quite flowing in the way that it might, that's shown up because of frustration at work, because of difficulties in relationships. One of the things about psychotherapy is that the presenting problem, you try, if this isn't too strange a way of putting it, try not to solve it too quickly. Because the sort of assumption is that problems are often disguising deeper issues, and that if you can get a focus on that deeper issue, then that's actually more releasing, more freeing in the longer term. So you don't get into sort of cycles of a problem recurring and a new technique, a new insight, a new sort of stone has been turned that may be interesting and may be practical and useful in some measure, but there's a sort of sense that you're not quite getting to the bottom of why you feel this distress in life, or why you feel things aren't quite right, or maybe quite dramatically not right as well.
Are you able, Mark, to take us back? I think your journey is really fascinating. So just to take us back down the journey you've been on to end up where you are today.
Yeah, well, so I was, I sort of began my adult professional life as a priest in the Church of England. I did what they call a curacy, which is like a 3-year period where you work very closely with a vicar, a sort of fully fledged clergy person, like an apprentice. But during that time, one way of putting it is that I realized it wasn't my thing. Another way of putting it was I sort of had a slow motion breakdown, really. And so I left, and then I started working as a journalist. It was back in the late 1990s, and so I started working particularly in the area of business and technology, because there was a lot of work that could be got there. And I'd done a physics degree earlier, so I didn't really know much about technology, to be honest, but at least I wasn't scared of it. And Yeah, so I started writing because writing was really the thing that interested me. And then I was doing kind of academic work. I did a PhD on Plato, but I never really got drawn to academic life. I was always much more interested in the practical side. I wanted things to change me, really, not just to learn more and more about less and less, which is sometimes how academic life can be portrayed. With the writing, started writing books. I wrote a book on friendship to start with. And that just gradually nudged me, you know, from the business and technology area into the more philosophical, spiritual, religious kind of area. And at the same time, did the psychotherapy training, partly to try and make some sense of what had happened before for me personally. But also because ancient philosophy, I think, Plato in particular, their stress is not kind of what you know abstractly, what you can prove and what you can analyze and break down. Much more of interest to them was what can you harmonize, what can you resonate with, what can you feel into, what can your imagination, your inspiration, your intuition reveal. And that very much rests on who you are as a person, you know, your qualities, your character, and what blocks you, and what frees you. And so the psychotherapy, funnily enough, actually felt much closer to ancient Greek philosophy than modern philosophy does. So there was a very personal side to psychotherapy, like there always is, because you kind of need that energy to make it work. But there was a sort of broader, you might say, inquiry into what is it to know something anyway, and how the imagination particularly plays into that.
So it seems like, I'm thinking back to the pandemic, but when a lot of people are perhaps faced with the mirror of looking internally, they seem to end up at Stoicism or Socrates. And that obviously had a big kind of mainstream revival, if you will, in the pandemic. Why do you think that is?
I think that, Stoicism in a way has never quite died. It's reinvented itself, but there was a kind of appeal during the pandemic for returning to roots. You know, what's the origin? What's the basic here? What's the kind of source wisdom, not just the endless variations? Because in a way, the heart of Stoicism is this dictum that it's not what happens to you that matters, but how you respond to what happens to you that matters. And the vast majority of self-help books are based on that dictum. How can you work on that which you can control, your response, rather than trying to fix things in terms of what's happening to you the whole time? So that's a very common notion, but the idea that there was a sort of source to this, the Stoics, and how returning to the original often, you know, refreshes things. I think that was part of the reason why Stoicism took hold afresh. I guess also because it being an ancient philosophy, it has a kind of aura of religion or even spirituality, but without being religious, which for many who got involved in Stoicism was a big turnoff. And in fact, I got a little bit involved in the debates because one of the things which I knew about ancient Stoicism was that it ultimately was about spiritual revelations. It wasn't just about sort of developing yourself so that you could go with the flow a bit better. Another great Stoic phrase, going with the flow, but was about how that revealed a deeper pulse or current of reality to you because you were less preoccupied with yourself, and that enables you to see more deeply into things. And the Stoics, particularly, they called that the logos, and this kind of word or current or impulse that was divine. And so ancient Stoicism was really about connecting with the divine. And it seemed to me that that's an important insight, because in a very individualistic world, you can sort of control certain things in your life if you're lucky, if you have the means to and so on. But if you see your life as primarily about being an autonomous individual, there's going to be limits to that. And so I felt that ancient Stoicism could bring back the deeper sense of that which we share, the collective sort of flow of life that we're part of. And it seemed to me that that was sort of around a bit in the pandemic as well, because whilst clearly, you know, there was a lot done to address the crisis itself threw up a kind of more deeper existential question, which is, you know, what do we think we're doing in the modern world anyway? And how much can we really control anyway? And what happens when things catch us by surprise? And ancient Stoicism has a kind of way of addressing that.
So, Mark, we have a lot of, call them high-flying businessmen on the podcast, millionaires. They've done some incredible things. And some of the questions that we sometimes ask is, when will enough be enough? When will you be content? And it feels like there's this, like, collective restlessness of, like, meaning in terms of, like, will I ever be fully happy? Will I ever accept that that is enough? How much of this do you think is down to the modern world that we're living in now?
Well, one way of answering that is to draw a bit on William Blake. In a rather clunky way, I've put my latest book just behind me on William Blake there. It just came out, so I'm sort of trying to drop that in whenever I can. But Blake, I think, is of interest because he has an answer to that question. He knew that particularly the modern soul, and he was born a couple of hundred years ago, so he's at the beginning of what we call the modern period. It's the beginning of mercantilism that became capitalism. So many of the features of our lives now were very familiar to him. And he recognized that that new impulse has a kind of upside and a downside. And the upside is that more ordinary folk can contribute to life. In the say medieval world anyway, where you were born more or less determines the kind of life that you lived, social stratification and so on. Whereas what was happening, particularly with the development of the cash economy and the capacity to make money as cash, not just say hold property and have your value in that way, meant that it produces more social fluidity. So people can have aspirations to leave where they were born and to make a success of their life materially. And Blake definitely valued that. He wanted to be commercially successful. He develops new printing techniques that he thinks are going to be more commercially successful. He feels he's got a message to give to the world that should be heard, you know, like any writer or painter. But he also realized that this new freedom had a kind of dark side, which it was focusing all that energy that it was releasing onto material gain. And so what might be a kind of spiritual yearning to resonate with more and more of the flow of life was getting directed into a kind of possessiveness, a desire to accumulate more and more of the material things in life. And he says, in one point, he has this phrase, he says, more is the cry of a mistaken soul. So accumulation, which he saw, you know, this was the age when London was opening its first arcades, when Adam Smith, you know, in the Wealth of Nations, he talks about seeing that people were wearing bigger and bigger coats. And he says, why are people wearing bigger and bigger coats? It's not like the weather has suddenly got colder. And then he realizes that a bigger coat has more pockets into which you can put the things that display your status, you know, your lovely snuff box, your beautiful pocket watch. And so Smith, too, he felt that this was going to be very ambivalent. It was going to make sort of happiness in a way, because stuff does bring happiness to a degree. But it was also going to lead to a new kind of suffering that the pure accumulation of things brings as well. The yearning for ever more material goods when you've kind of got enough to live by already. So Blake sees this more as the cry of a mistaken soul. But what I really like about Blake is he doesn't say, therefore, okay, you must stop your desire. You must take up an ascetic life. The desire for material goods is somehow bad. He says, no, it's the first, though, awakening of the desire for not just more and more that he thinks we human beings have, but for what he calls the all or the infinite or the eternal. And Blake felt that at the heart of what it is to be human is the divine, is a kind of infinite capacity, is a sense and taste for the eternal. And unless you recognize that, the very desire that leads you to want more and more stuff will constantly be frustrated as well at the same time. And so you get people who get onto these spirals, particularly if they're good at making more money. But they also then might say to people like you, you know, but somehow I can't get off that hedonic treadmill. And Blake would say that's because it's fine to want more and more. But what you've got to release into is actually not just the accumulation of this and that, but an appreciation that in all things can be sensed the infinite, can be seen the eternal. And so some of Blake's best known phrases resonate with this. So he, you know, he says these things like, to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower. You know, very ordinary things, a grain of sand and a wild flower. And yet the appreciation of the heaven that's in the wild flower and the whole cosmos, if you like, that's in the sand, that is going to lead to a much more satisfactory life for we human beings. And so, you know, the artist that devotes their life to doing that, the scientist that devotes their life to doing that, and the poet, you know, that does so. That's why I think, you know, this constant sort of struggle in the modern world. We're a bit, in one moment, rather down on the arts, but somehow then get reminded that we sort of need them somehow too. And we're not quite sure why. You know, people say, well, it adds a bit of colour, a bit of entertainment to life. But Blake would say, no, the reason why we need the arts is because they satisfy the deepest yearnings of the human soul. And if you push that to one side, even if you're doing well in life materially, you're also committing yourself to a way of life that's going to constantly frustrate you as well.
I like that. And when you were talking about the coat analogy, it made me think, like, in the modern world, that is very much so. How many followers do I have on TikTok and Twitter and all of these lovely things? So if we think about the hedonic treadmill, and people are listening to the podcast and they're thinking, I might be walking towards a spiritual awakening. What do you typically find is the first step that people take towards that?
It's normally some kind of breakdown. It's normally some, it might be gentle, a gradual realization that the path that you're on isn't you. I mean, people often talk these days about being the best version of myself, and they realize that when they go to work, they have to kind of hang that aspiration up at the door. Because their work environment is demanding something else of them, and they put up with that for a while. And, you know, we all have to do that to a degree. We all wear roles in some measure. But when that role, that what you might call false self, becomes too uncoupled from your true self, from who you really feel you might be, then it becomes, gradually or maybe quite suddenly becomes untenable. People might have literally a breakdown. Or they might just kind of sense dissatisfaction rising gently. Or, you know, more positively, they might have a child, or they might fall in love, or they might discover that they love music and they love the outdoors. And so, I don't know, having been an accountant, they want to become a lumberjack. This happened to a friend of mine. So he went and started volunteering for the National Trust, and eventually got into land management, where actually rather beautifully, the old accountancy came together with the land management. So that was a really wonderful resolution of what was quite a crisis at one point. So I think that, you know, breakdowns and not trying to resolve it too quickly are often the way that people find the path into a deeper or richer, more expansive life.
So I've become increasingly more fascinated with what makes religion stick. So obviously there's been thousands of religions in human lifetimes, but it seems like the thing that makes them stick is the story, right? So the ones that have kind of the best stories that are accepted in different communities tend to do the best. What do you think is the role of story in meaning?
I think what a good story can do, and incidentally, just in parenthesis, sometimes there's a difference maybe between a story and a myth. And a myth, in the sense that I'm using it, is a story that wasn't written by one person, but somehow emerged from a community, from a society, from some kind of shared engagement with life, and particularly life and death, say. And a great myth is a story that can hold you in the particular place you find yourself, but give it a wider context. And so deliver the confidence that you can tolerate what might be a difficult moment, because this is the moment when you're walking through the forest and you're waiting for the clearing. You know, these kind of motifs that appear in myths, they speak to us very profoundly, psychologically or spiritually, and because they're ways of talking about experiences that people have in life. And so I think the great religions have these great myths. It might be focused on a figure, might be focused on a saint. It may be more cosmological. You know, they have a kind of story of the unfolding of all things. And the point is, their truth is not, is the story literally true or not? It's more, does this story transmit something to me that in a way is beyond straightforward articulation? And so its truth is in that depth. It's something that my brain, as it were, can't wholly get around, but by the actions that I perform, maybe going on pilgrimages or performing rituals, singing, music, the poetry, literature of scriptures and so on, it's all that is communicating something which I know to be true, even if one particular formula couldn't quite summarize it up. It's radiating, this story is radiating with what's good, beautiful and true, you might say, and also is able to hold darkness and difficulty, but put it into a wider frame. So I think the great religions have that as part of their core, yeah. And we test religions, therefore, by the truth of their story in that wider sense, not historically. I mean, it's got to have some sort of resonance with history, I think, but that's not going to decide it, actually. What's going to decide it is whether it saves people. And by that, it's meant provides a frame within which people can live their lives. And those religions that survive are the ones that do that.
So what is it then about human nature that can take those stories and suddenly they go from an understanding of meaning to a tribal, maybe problematic identity instead?
Well, I think that the great stories always emerge in a kind of collective context. There may well be a kind of originating charismatic figure. I mean, let's take one that's relatively uncontroversial from the ancient philosophical world, which would be the figure of Socrates. So Socrates was definitely a historical figure. No one doubts that. He was quite a significant player in a strange way in ancient Athens, particularly in its period where it was moving from war with the Spartans, the Peloponnesian War, into this kind of proto-democracy. And then he was found guilty by the Athenian jury and died by drinking hemlock. You know, all those, there are certain facts about Socrates, but quite, well, maybe what he taught is fairly clear, that what he taught was based something on asking questions for yourself, trying to work out who you were as an individual in relation to the wider context. But the way that that was developed, then takes on a life of its own. And so even one writer like Plato, who nearly in all his works references or has Socrates even as the main figure, it's different kinds of Socrates that show up in different works. And so this Aboriginal figure, if you like, has already become more to his followers than he might have even been in life, or at least the perspective, you might say, that a different person would take to the figure of Socrates when they were alive would be a bit like a mirror and would show up something more to them than they saw. So that the kind of meaning of Socrates, if you like, was emerging from in between Socrates' followers and Socrates himself. It was drawing out a kind of third thing, if you like. And I think that most great, I'm partly making this up as a theory now, but interested to see whether you find it plausible. I think that the great founders of the great religious traditions, it's something like that that's happened. And so if you go sort of squirreling down and trying to discover the historical Socrates or the historical Jesus or the historical Muhammad, you'll never quite get there. But also you'll sort of be eroding what it matters really about Socrates and Jesus and Muhammad in the process as well, which is about how they, you know, if you're the follower of, say, Socrates, how that figure can speak to you now. And that's going to be from a broader context. They're absolutely crucial, but it's something that they catalyze as much as maybe spoke directly. So again, there's a, it's something about the resonance, you might say, of a particular tradition and how that carries more and more with it. And so becomes diverse. You know, there's not one Christianity, there's many different Christianities. But that, I think, is, it needs testing, it needs discerning, and it can be very troubling, particularly to the kind of modern mindset that somehow thinks everything should be a bit like physics. You should be able to sort of pin it down. Incidentally, I was talking to a physicist just yesterday, as it happened, and we were talking about what counts as proof in physics. And of course, there's a huge discussion amongst physicists about what counts as proof that's particularly coming to the fore now with the increasing involvement of, well, computers, but now AI in science. Because a more, you might say, mathematically inclined physicist will say, no, we haven't really got a new bit of physics until we've got a formula, until we've got an equation, because that's like a real insight into reality. Whereas there's been other kind of physicists that says, no, it doesn't matter what equation we have. What we need is inputs that produce outputs, and AIs are great at doing that. They can spot the pattern. We don't have to know why the pattern or what the pattern is. We just need to know that there's things we can test. Now, they're very different standards of proof. One's a kind of insight, one's just something very pragmatic. So the funny thing is that even in the so-called hard sciences, these things are much developed. And I suppose what I'm arguing for is a kind of pragmatic approach, in the sense that someone like William James might have meant it, which is that truth itself might always kind of elude us, but it's in the fruits of what we have that we know that we're onto the truth. And I think this is very much the case in religious traditions.
So it feels like, whether it be religion or philosophy, that fills that gap that some people are looking to feel and make them feel more content to move forward in life. Where does spiritual intelligence come into the conversation with that?
Spiritual intelligence, it's a phrase. People will define it in different ways, if they use it at all. Some will say it's just kind of an extension of emotional intelligence. So emotional intelligence is the capacity to work with your feelings, not be overwhelmed by them, but to use them as a kind of guide, or be able to navigate feelings in a group or in a room. And the spiritual just be an extension of the emotional in some way or other, you know, perhaps where meaning and purpose is felt, for example. I think actually spiritual intelligence can be defined in a different way, which is about the kind of ground of our being. It's about not just that we're aware of certain things, but that capacity to be aware itself can be developed. The kind of intuition can be turned up, if you like. And so I think spiritual intelligence is about the capacity to not just process things, but to foster who we are before, in a way, we've even started processing things. It's presence, if you like. That maybe is a good word. You know, so someone who has great spiritual intelligence, they may well utter words of wisdom, but really, when you encounter them, you feel their presence. You think, goodness me, they've kind of got something. And I don't know quite what it is, but I just know it. And, you know, there's some figures that become very well known for this. You know, many will meet the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama will say something, probably something quite simple, actually. But that's not the point. The point is that they felt this person is transmitting something much more than just, you know, who they are as an individual. And I think that's because they've got a great spiritual intelligence. They're able to resonate and harmonize with a kind of side of life that's bigger than just them. And you feel that when you meet these people.
So is it, so we take the Dalai Lama into like an example. Is it something that you're born with, or is it a nature nurture? Is it a skill set? And if it falls into that skill set bracket, how would one say, right, okay, my spiritual intelligence is a one. I'm now going to go and spend the next 6 months and get that to a 10. Where do I start?
Yeah, I mean, one of the funny things about spiritual intelligence is that I think you have to put yourself in a kind of receptive mode, but ultimately it's probably something that comes to you. And maybe that's not so surprising. You know, I think a lot of the things that we learn, you have to kind of do the work, but then you need that extra sort of grace or je ne sais quoi or inspiration. You know, so the great author that writes a novel has to do all the work of actually sitting down day by day, putting words on a screen or a page. But they'll sort of say that in the best moments, the characters started speaking to me, that they started, they revealed what should happen next in the story, for example. And I think a lot of people that have had moments of inspiration would think of it like that. You have to do the work, but then you have to kind of keep at least a part of you that's patient enough to wait for the breakthrough. And so I think that spiritual intelligence is like that completely, that you need to be able to, as it were, do the work that enables you to get out of your own way. So understanding how you are working now, you know, your assumptions that you bring that maybe serve you quite well in life, but also might block off, you know, so if you were a very rational person, that can be very good in many contexts, but perhaps it leaves you less imaginative. Or if you're a very intuitive person, that serves you very well in many contexts, but perhaps you find it quite hard to decide things. So you need a more kind of rational capacity as well. So it's about knowing yourself, a great Socratic phrase, of course, know thyself. But then being in a receptive place to receive this more. You know, the psychotherapist would talk about something coming from the unconscious. The spiritual person might talk more about something coming from God or from the divine. You know, the artist might leave it a little bit in a kind of uncertain space. They might talk about the imagination or that kind of thing. Spiritual intelligence requires, I think, this capacity for receptivity. So the preparation isn't going to let you go from like 0 to 10 in a 6 month program. But what it might do in a 6 month program is leave you more receptive. And that might be quite painful and difficult because it is about letting go of that which you sort of trust more and you feel, but this is really me. So often again, you know, breakdowns and difficulty, the shadow, these kind of elements people would talk about as being part of the development of spiritual intelligence.
One of the interesting things about having AI at our fingertips now, Mark, is you can ask AI a lot of these big questions, and obviously it can consult the information available to it. And I asked it a scary question the other day around how rational it believes human beings are in their lifetime, the percentage of their life they spend being rational. And it was below 20%. It said below 20% of your life, you will be a rational human being. What it then depicted was this idea that you are actually being dragged around by an irrational version of yourself that sometimes milliseconds afterwards is being justified by the rational version, the irrational version being a little bit faster than the rational version. Do you then think free will is possible if that's true?
I think what free will is about, it's not the ability to do what the hell you like any moment of the day or night. You know, I'm not free to suddenly decide that I want to live underwater permanently, for example. You know, that would be and if I base my freedom on the capacity to do that sort of thing, I would condemn myself to a very unhappy life. But what I think freedom is about is that we can reflect on who we are. You know, we have not just consciousness, but self-consciousness, not just awareness, but self-awareness. And that brings a freedom to not in a moment change who we are, but over time become a very different person. And that, I think, is where our freedom lies. So, you know, when people talk about free will and they debate, you know, is it just the capacity, you know, I decide to raise my hand or something and then someone puts you in a brain scanner and they see that there's a little impulse that happened a few milliseconds, maybe that's what you're referring to, you know, before. And they say, well, you weren't really deciding whether to raise your hand. I mean, those kind of arguments, I think they're they're not very rational, actually, because the point about that kind of experiment is that where does it begin? You know, where's the first moment? You need, for example, people to take part in the trials. So you have to go out and ask people to take part in a trial. You've already set up a whole chain of decision making. You can't decide where the first moment for the raising of the hand begins. So they're on a hiding to nothing. And this is the critique of that kind of experiment. The AI may pick it up because there's a hell of a lot talked about it on the internet. And of course, the AI doesn't understand anything. It's just in a very elaborate way, reflecting back to you what is out there already. So I think that that, to come to your particular point, that we're not rational for much of the time, is because life itself ultimately can't be pinned down to the purely rational. But what you can do is use a rational moment where you say, okay, this is how I've been in life, and I know it's not serving me well. I'm going to understand it a bit better, and then try and lean into other possibilities and develop a kind of awareness of that. Now, the deciding to do that is rational, but it's guided really by feelings, by intuitions, by the knocks and blows of life, as well as the sense that actually this feels expansive, this feels better in some way. That's not strictly rational, but it's really where the heart of life lies. So, you know, that we're not rational for most of the time, I think, is to say that we're actually living, we're not inert algorithms, you know, that do try to be rational. If that's what's going on inside an AI, of course, people debate quite what's going on inside a neural network. It may be completely irrational too, but it just happens to produce the right results.
So it feels like the kind of through line, just to echo it back, is perhaps there are no fundamental truths that you arrive at. Perhaps there is no fundamental evidence of an authentic or inauthentic self. You know, all these big questions, but actually in the pursuit of trying to answer the question, you will arrive at lots of little things that perhaps make you see the bigger picture in a way that's a bit more palatable. Is that fair? Am I interpreting what you're saying correctly?
Yeah, the fruit, it's in the fruit. By their fruits ye shall know them, as Jesus said. But I do think there's truth, though. And I do think that, you know, we human beings are creatures that have a sense and taste for what's good, for what's beautiful, what's true. And we dispute endlessly whether this thing is good or that thing is beautiful. But the point is, we have the conversation. The disaster would happen when we even stopped having the conversation, or the disaster would happen when something terrible happens and no one cared. Terrible things undoubtedly happen, but people care. And that, to me, says that, you might say, the love is stronger than the jealousy or the hate that led to the terrible thing. So, you know, we human beings are creatures in time. It's constantly unfolding, constantly changing for us. But I think that there is a kind of direction of travel that maybe, as Aristotle said, you only really see on your deathbed. And when you have a kind of flashback for your life and you think, oh, actually, I was trying to pursue what I thought was good, even for all the mistakes I made. And then Aristotle says you can die happy. The trick is to have that capacity to reflect on things, you know, as they're happening as well.
And then, Mark, one of the things that you've spoken about a lot is a lot of the symptoms are you probably hit that breakdown, that breaking point, that rock bottom, whatever you call it. There'll be people probably listening to this now, especially if they're in the rat race of 9 to 5, they're in sales, that they're just feeling like, me and Zach have had this conversation many a times, but we look back to our mid-20s and we think, what are we doing with our lives? Like, what is the point? And then eventually you come out of that. What are maybe some low stakes things that they can start? What is the first rung on the ladder if you've reached that kind of that breaking point? Where do I go next?
I think a good thing is to notice it and to take it seriously. I mean, sometimes we don't notice these things until we reach some kind of midpoint in life. Because as Carl Jung said, it's then you realize that the sun doesn't continue rising in the morning sky indefinitely. It reaches a kind of noon point overhead. And then, horror, it starts to fall in the afternoon sky. And so you reach, I don't know if you count it as 35 or 45, but you realize anyway that the sun is not going to just keep rising in your life. And so recognizing that, trying to not just react to it by bringing in some more distractions or throwing yourself even more into the path that you've taken, or, you know, feeling the fear and trying to do something that helps you feel around the fear and not just be frozen by that kind of realization. And that might be, you know, talking to someone. It may be talking to friends, of course. It may be talking to someone like a therapist. It may be trying to bring in a new practice in your life. You know, it might be experimenting with what you're reading, or going to live events, not just consuming things online. All these things that bring people into a kind of wider energy, if you like. And then that can enable a process that begins you to sort of start stepping out of the life you've been living. But the first step, I think, would be to try and pay attention. And then the second step would be, so what do I need to reflect upon what I'm noticing? And that might be someone else. It might be kind of how you're living your life, what you're doing. But I suppose not just try and build in more and more distractions to kind of anaesthetize the dawning sense of dread.
It feels like the obvious thing to do is, okay, things aren't going my way, I'm breaking down. What can I do to kind of, who can I be around? What can I do? What can I put in my body? What can I distract my mind with? I think like there's so many great takeaways there, Mark. I've absolutely loved this conversation. I feel like we've only just scratched the surface with you. Like there's probably like loads more that we could pick your brain on. If people want to work with you or read your work, how would you best suggest them to go about that?
Yeah, well, thanks for, you know, inviting me on. And I think that the conversations like this in themselves are part of the work. You know, you ask me a question, I try and reach for something that connects with what you're saying, then you're thinking, so what can I come back? You know, that is the kind of process of revelation. I wonder whether people, that's part of what's happening with this podcast medium, actually, is that when they're at their best, they're kind of revelatory. And that's because it's happening in the moment. And that itself inspires people, actually. So look, you know, thanks for inviting me on, and, you know, keep up the good work too. But, you know, always have something to sell. Someone once told me. And so I have a website, markvernon.com. And so you can find my books, and I do quite a lot of podcasting myself for the reasons I've just explained. Actually, I think it is quite a particular kind of medium when it's done well. So I use social media, YouTube, I have a Substack, those kind of things. Yeah, but markvernon.com, you should be able to find links.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks, you, Mark. To you guys.